Well, could you first tell me, Mr. John Wolfenden, where and when you were born?
I was born in Southport on the 7th of December 1940.
What were the names of your parents?
George Bentley Wolfenden and Amy Wolfenden.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was a director of, originally of Fitch Lovell, an old firm called Lovell and Christmas, and then left there and bought his own wholesale provision merchant, which he ran in Liverpool.
What had your grandparents done, do you know?
I don't know, because my grandfather, my father's father, died when he was very young, about two, I think. And my mother's father, to be honest, I forget.
What exactly did Fitch Lovell do?
Well, it was originally a firm called Lovell and Christmas, who were wholesale provision merchants, and they were taken over by a small firm called Fitch and became Fitch Lovell.
I see. So in that sense, the family didn't have any stock exchange connections, did they?
Correct. That was absolutely correct. Yep.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a brother who is 2 years younger than me.
And what did he do with his life?
He went to work for a firm called Simpson Roberts, which became Prince's Foods and became part of the Bibby Empire. He then left, and he now runs a holding company, which is he and I have an interest in. Well, I have a small interest in, it controls two laundries, a printing works, a sign writing business, and things like that.
Where did your parents send you to school?
I went to Uppingham in Rutland. I think it's now called Leicestershire.
Did you have any idea what kind of career you'd like to pursue when you were at school?
Yes, I wanted to become a lawyer.
And what actually happened when you did leave school?
I got fed up with the exams and therefore didn't take up the place I had at university. And was offered two or three jobs, but in fact ended up by going to work for a stockbroking firm, which my father knew through dealing in the stock exchange in Liverpool.
What was the name of that firm?
A.S. Milnes and Co.
Did you have much idea about what stockbrokers did or what stock exchanges did at that age?
A little bit, because obviously my father had spoken a bit about it and what he was doing, but also my last term at school, the first lesson of the term was to pick a company from the back page of the FT, and the last lesson of the term was to then discuss what had happened to that company during the course of the term, and we had to draw a chart as to what happened. Coming from the north of England, I chose a share called the Cunard Steamship Company, and it went from A to A. I say A to A because it didn't move, and I thought there's got to be more to the stock exchange than this. I mean, the share price just didn't move virtually all term, and others had theirs going up and down like yo-yos. So I then started to make a few more inquiries, and within a month joined a firm as the office boy so I could learn my way around Liverpool, because I'd got no idea.
Did you have any particular long-term ambitions for yourself at that stage?
No, I don't think so. No.
What would you have said the attitude to money had been at home? Would you say there was no particular attitude?
Well, money wasn't discussed an awful lot.
Yes.
I don't think one was taught to be how to run. Father would always say, "Listen, this is how you run a bank account," and so on. Of course, he got a nasty shock one day, and he said, "You're going to need some money today," because I was becoming a member of the stock exchange in 1964, and you had to write out a few hefty checks at that stage, comparatively speaking, anyhow. And on the way down to the bank to meet the bank manager, I had to disclose to my father that I already had an overdraft, which was, of course, a bit of a shock.
Now, you mentioned that your first job was office boy with A.S. Miller.
Yeah.
Can you remember roughly when it was that you joined them?
It was the 2nd or 3rd of January, 1960.
How would you describe the firm at that time?
Oh, it was a small two-partner private client firm, dealing purely with private individuals, some of whom came through banks and solicitors and accountants. And basically, therefore, it was contacts built up by the partners and the ex-partner and the current partners that were there and members of the staff.
Do you have any recollection of what the offices were actually like?
Yeah, quite vividly. It was in an old building called State House in Dale Street in Liverpool, 14 Dale Street. You went in a rickety old, up a rickety old lift. And the offices were on, there was a sort of, the forerunner to an atrium, I suppose. And the offices were sort of off, there are all sorts of offices in there, from solicitors and accountants to ourselves and all sorts of things. And the offices were very small, and we were off, sort of, off this sort of galleried atrium. They were actually quite, no money had been spent on them for years. In fact, I don't think any. Well, we did. We painted it two or three years later.
Now, what did one do as an office boy in a firm like A.S. Milne?
Well, the main thing was to try and learn learn my way around Liverpool. And you would take hand deliveries, go down to the bank, run across the Stock Exchange, which was just over the road. And when I say office boy, it was really a junior clerk. And you'd do the what was then called the clearing. We still, even, we had the fortnightly settlement for equities. And it was all done manually in a big clearing. It was called a clearing house. It was a big room in the Stock Exchange. And that's where the majority of people got there, gained a lot of experience.
Exchange at that time have compared with the London Exchange, say, in terms of size?
Oh, very small. I can't remember how many firms there were. They'd begun to shrink in number. When I say in number, I mean there was a. It was something like four. Might have been 52. But over the years, the Liverpool Stock Exchange firm shrank from 52 to single figures. And I think currently they're about six or seven. But the number of members at that stage, I mean, it's not called the Liverpool Stock Exchange now, but the last, when it finally became the Northern Unit and then part of the International Stock Exchange and this, the actual, although the firms had shrunk dramatically, the actual number of members was still almost the same as it had been when there were a large number of firms. So the people employed were still probably about the same. They just got, firms had got together for save costs and just to grow bigger.
Do you have any recollection of whether the firm did business with other exchanges? Or did it all do it on Liverpool Exchange?
We did. Well, I ended up, after sort of the compulsory year working in the office, because you couldn't go onto the floor until you'd had a year's experience, I ended up very shortly after that doing the majority of the deals for the firm on the floor. So I didn't actually go out and get a lot of business. I was the dealer. And the majority of deals were done on the floor with people that we called shunters. Although there were certain stocks which you knew you'd get a better market in elsewhere. For example, there was an insurance jobber up in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. Well, shunter again. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we'd deal there. And of course, the other thing is you'd deal in London through an agent. Mm-hmm. And then we used to have a fixed time call. Well, actually three or four during the day, fixed time calls when we would speak to him on the telephone and give orders, but you could always ring him anyhow.
So just to be a bit more explicit, a fixed time call was a call that would take place every day.
Every day, every day at about five past ten. There'd be another one about 11, one at 12, and there'd be two in the afternoon. Mm. The times escape my memory now.
Were you restricted in the number of agents you could have?
No, we actually used one because he had been known to the partners of the firm, because he'd originally been on the exchange in Liverpool, a fellow called Roy Marshall, and he came to London and started up his own firm, Roy Marshall & Co., and we used them most of the time. There was another firm, but we didn't give them an awful lot of business.
And did you have to pay these firms the full commission that one would normally pay to any broker on the London Exchange who was doing a transaction for you?
No, not quite. There was a reduced commission to pay. And you could come to certain arrangements. Sometimes they'd do they would do you a... I mean, if I was dealing myself, I can remember once dealing for myself, and I happened to say, oh, well, that was for me. And he said, oh, forget it, no charge. So, but no, basically, there was a... As there were fixed commissions for your clients, there was indeed something almost like half commission, but not quite. It was a sliding scale between the agent and yourself.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a bit more on what the shunters did?
Yeah, because I ultimately joined a firm which was a shunter. Shunter would have, there'd be a firm in, well, I mean, let's talk about the firm that I joined. It was called Henry Rensburg. There would be a London end to the telephone line, and we had the Birmingham end had closed down, but when I joined them, but there was London, Manchester, and Liverpool. Ultimately, Manchester called that closed down as well, so it was just ourselves and London end. And this was an open telephone line. It was a private line, and you would start off in the morning, you know, the old type thing where you had to turn a handle and the bell rang at the far end. And they had a list. It was a big pad of all the stocks which we were shunting in. And they would give us the prices which they found in the London market. Now, if for example, Aykroyd and Smithers were making a share 3.6, and Weds were making it 4.5, 7.5, I'm talking in old pennies at this stage, then the price that would be put up to us would be 4.5, 6, because that was the touch. In fact, they might, in fact, just put on one price, 5 pence farthing, because we used to go up in 3 farthings in those days. And we would then make a price on the spread, making a turn either side. And again, there was a rate, there was a agreed figure. Again, I can't remember the scales, but let's say on a share of, say, about 50 bob, that the turn was, say, 1.5p, or something, well, 1.5p, I'm talking about today, a penny halfpenny. We would split that. You'd time, so if the share was offered at 50 and threepence, we'd try and sell it on, or somebody would come along and ask us what the price was, we'd hopefully say 50 and fourpence halfpenny, and that penny halfpenny, or if the dealer was very good in London and he got the stock cheaper than threepence, i.e. tuppence farthing, we would then split it at normally 50-50. And that would, that was our, in quotes, commission.
And did the shunters actually stand on the floor of the various provincial exchanges?
Yes.
Would you?
You had one fellow sitting down taking with his ear to the phone, or more likely one of these old headsets on, jotting down the prices, because their prices keep on changing. It's not, you don't just take a list every hour. The prices keep on changing. So he's making note of these, and he's got a couple of dealers standing by him. And you used to know that if somebody called out Westland Aircraft, it was at the bottom right of the list. How the hell that comes back to me after all this time, I don't know, but that's where it was. The gilts are at the top left, and so on.
Now, how did it work, say, for example, at the London end? Were, again, was it simply a case of a member broker in the London Stock Exchange acting as the London end of the shunting operation.
Yeah, yes, they had some little boxes in Shorter's Court. I mean, the box wasn't the size of this office. I mean, it was about, at one stage, it was about the size of this desk, with a little window out onto Shorter's Court, and there were railings there, and they built up a step on the railings, so when a dealer came out of the market, he could just stand on that and pass bits of paper in through the little hatch. And there was a girl called Minnie. Minnie, that was it. Sitting down there, and she would give the prices up and down, receive our orders, and report back to us. And occasionally the dealer would want to argue with you about the price or try and tell you a story about how clever he'd been at getting at squeezing an extra penny halfpenny or something. And so he'd come on and take the phone. When I first knew, this was a firm called Moy Vanderbilt, or Moy Davis Smith Vanderbilt. When I first met them, they were still using the candlestick telephone. In fact, we had one, there was one in Liverpool as well on the floor, where when they used to call us to the phones, they had we had two telephonists. I don't mean the female variety. There were two fellas, and they had and they used to call us, and all the phone calls that they got in would come through their candlestick telephone. They'd then put them through to one of these slightly more modern jobs in the boxes. But that was basically how it worked.
Well, can we go through the steps by which you came to join Rendsburg? You said at one point, after about a year, you became a dealer.
Yes.
Or Milne. Did one have to go through the equivalent of what would have been a blue button on the London Exchange?
Yes, indeed. But I wasn't a blue button for long. I've forgotten what happened. I think the other fellow who was our dealer at the stage was ill. And yes, we did. Then we took a thing called the clearinghouse exam. Most people had to take that in any case. I became a dealer, and I actually became a member of the Stock Exchange in 1964. Excuse me. And became a partner in the firm within a week or two of becoming a member. I lasted as a partner for about 6 months, because in the meantime, a fellow came to me and said, listen, we're going to start jobbing, and would you like to come along and have a go? And I said, well, that interested me, because I was more interested in dealing than in going out and speaking to clients. I mean, I always found it embarrassing going to the bar at the golf club and meeting somebody who you put into Rolls Razor had gone bust or things like that. And I decided that wasn't the life for me, not being a salesman. And so I rather jumped at the idea of being able to just deal. So that's the reason I left. I didn't fall out with them. In fact, we remained friendly until both my old partners, in fact, died. In fact, my old firm, that old firm, A.S. Milnes, is still in existence in Liverpool with mergers, and the name Milnes is still used in the title of the current firm. That's how I came to change firms.
So,
I can tell you exactly, it was 25 years ago last week.
This was a new jobbing firm that was being...
Well, it was a shunting firm originally.
I see.
In those days, the country were, dare I say it, ahead of London. We had a thing called, would you believe, dual capacity. And Henry E. Rendsburg & Co., in its full title of that day, was not only a broker dealing for clients, but it had this shunting side. It also ran a book and really was a jobber in government securities as well. which it had done for years, because the firm started about 125 odd years or more, 130, 140 years ago now, dealing in home rails, which is how the Liverpool and Manchester stock exchanges sprang up, to deal in the railway shares. And when they got nationalised and government stock was issued, that's how the firm got into dealing in gilts. And that's where it stayed, well, indeed, I mean, with amalgamations, it's now part of this firm. So we had these three businesses going, and they decided to stop the shunting, and instead of shunting, in other words, which was undoing your position immediately, you know, if we sold 3,000 IKEA shares, we'd go into the market to buy them back immediately, trying to get this penny, halfpenny, or whatever, if you could get threepence, it was even better, at the turn. So instead of doing the shunting, we were going to try running a book, in fact, therefore jobbing. And that's what I joined the firm to set up. The senior partner and a couple of others had started in a minor way. I joined them, was sent to London to Durlacher, Oldham, Mordant, Godson for 2 or 3 months training, and then returned to Liverpool and ran part of the equity book for a few years.
Why was it that Henry Rensburg had decided to try and do a bit of pure jobbing?
Because we'd had the experience of doing it in gilts for some time, and we'd had the experience of shunting, which was sort of trading in a way, and the idea being that if you're jobbing, and we'd still use the same agent in London, because we didn't actually deal direct at that stage, the idea was that we might be able to increase the profitability of the firm.
Yes. Is there any particular reason why you went to Durlacher? Did the firm have some association with Durlacher?
No, I think the senior partner of the day, on his, because he was a member of the Liverpool committee, and I think that he obviously met other people, and at some stage had met somebody from Durlacher's when he was in London, and struck up a little bit of a friendship. This was how it was arranged.
What form did your training take? Were you standing on a pitch?
Yep, I was a member of the Stock Exchange in Liverpool, but that wasn't really acknowledged on the floor of the London market, and I had to go to them before a small interview. I suppose it would be of the membership committee, I don't know, in the old council room in London, to apply for a blue button. So here was I, a member of the Liverpool Stock Exchange, standing on the floor in London with a blue button on, and technically not allowed to deal. But yes, I stood on Durlacher's leader book pitch for some weeks, and you know, I had an idea of how the system worked quite obviously after a few years in the business. And they just, it was just, you pick it up remarkably quickly.
Who was running the leader book at that time?
A fellow called David Johnson.
How did you find actually going into the London House? Was it very different to the Liverpool House?
Oh yes, it's much bigger, much bigger. I mean, the Liverpool floor would have fitted into a tiny corner of the old London floor.
What was the attitude to provincial members, among members of the London Stock Exchange? I mean, you've already mentioned it to a point.
They were very, very friendly. There was no... there was no animosity, and you might think, well, here are you setting up as a jobber in the country, and yet there are jobbers in London. Why should they help you? Why should they deal with you? They did. I mean, we used to deal, again, through our agent, and then occasionally we'd deal direct. But they were quite happy because they realised that if you were dealing, it was fresh business, as it were, a position that you wanted to undo, but that it would be, particularly in gilts, you'd have done a lot of small deals to get a decent order. So in a way, you were acting as a clearinghouse. And if you sold or bought stock, if you bought, they would deliver one deed to you. And if I sold to them, they bought, the chances were that I'd deliver one deed to them. Although my 100,000 pounds of stock might be made up of 50 or more deals. So they were quite happy for that. So it's a bit of give and take. Of course, there's always a little bit of animosity, but it wasn't too much. And it was normally only just a few firms, or more likely, in fact, individuals in the firm who didn't see why the firm was helping or supporting you. So it depended, and you knew who they were, so you just didn't go to them.
Were there other Liverpool firms setting up as offices?
Yes, we had... well, originally there were one, two, three, four, five... There were seven firms in Liverpool that shunted or made a very small book in local breweries or something like that. But of those firms, there were four large ones who were big shunters. So we were all competing against each other to get our prices and to do the deals and to undo the shunting deal in London, because we all had different agents. So you could imagine sometimes you could see an order going around the market floor from it just suddenly landed, and there were three or four different firms in London running around trying to undo a bit of country business. It must have been a fine sight. Now, there was a lot of leg pulling going on when that sort of thing happened.
When you went back up to Liverpool, how did you go about setting up the pitch? Did you simply replicate what you'd seen in London?
Certainly on the actual book, I mean the physical book we entered the bargains in, that was a direct copy. But no, the rest of it, we it's the same back office system. In those days it was manual. And so there was, everybody had virtually the same, ran the business the same way. The individuals ran a book a different way. You had different ideas of what should move a market. That was one of the things that makes up a market, I suppose.
And the actual technicalities of jobbing, of quoting a price,
mm-hmm.
Running your bull or your bear positions, was that more or less the same as what a jobber would have been doing in London?
On a much smaller scale, yes. Because we wouldn't do the very big bargains. Because there weren't often. I mean, that sort of business wasn't often in the country. And I can remember that we used to have... there were firms, if they got a big order, they would do it in London automatically. I mean, they were entitled to. And they wouldn't give us a look at it, because quite often it was rather nice to say to their clients, oh, well, we dealt with Aykroyd, or we dealt with Wed, or Durlacher. They were household names, well, almost, whereas to have dealt with us, there was no, I suppose the word is kudos. But we fought it, and sometimes they did give us some decent orders. Quite amazing, really, the size of some of the business in the country.
When you say you fought it, what do you mean? Would you?
Well, we just kept on going out and selling ourselves to these various firms, and ultimately and persuading them that we were we weren't fly by nights, and we were a reasonable firm, and we were there to stay at it. And then, of course, we packed up because we had three businesses going. As I said earlier on, we had the broking side. We had the gilt edge jobbing side, and then we had the equity jobbing side. And at one stage, there were more jobbers in certain stocks, for example, ICI and Courtaulds, in the country than there were in London. And we came to the conclusion that this was stupid, and it's rather like today's overcapacity in the market. And we thought, how can we alter this and rationalize things? So we approached a number of the other country jobbers and said, listen, we will give up jobbing in store shares if you're prepared to give up jobbing in brewery shares, say. Or pick your own sector. You know, we don't mind. We were fairly big. And we just said that this was the way to the sensible way to approach the market and cut back all this, not cut back the competition, but make it hopefully a better market by actually just rationalising a bit, because it was stupid having more jobbers out there than in London. Anyhow, we got nowhere with that. And as it was approaching sort of the late 60s, it might have been the early 70s, very early 70s, yeah. We knew that we were going into a federation with the stock exchanges, and we knew that dual capacity was going to have to come to an end, and we'd have to split the firm into brokers and jobbers. And all the rules were changing. We decided that we needed to take more people on to stand still, because there were these three sides of the business. And we decided that rather than do that, and we couldn't actually see that it was a tremendous future in the equity jobbing business at that stage, we decided to drop out of equities and use all our staff by concentrating them then into gilts and the broking side. And we didn't take anybody else on. And we had a staff that was used to, they knew what they were doing. So that's what we did. We gave up equity jobbing and split the staff between the broking side and the gilt.